Over 4.5 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's, a dreaded disease that slowly eats away at the brain's ability to remember and function. It's a nightmare for patients that grow angry and frustrated, and for their loved ones who have to care for them. Eventually, it leads to death. The number of Alzheimer's patients has more than doubled since 1980. There is no cure. But now there is new hope. This week at the annual meeting of the American Association of Neurologists, medical researchers presented the results of the latest studies on the treatment and diagnosis of Alzheimer's. All say it's early yet, more testing needs to be done, but now there is a feeling of cautious optimism. We'll bring you up to date on these promising results. Later in the program, the House Ethics Committee and the House Majority Leader, Tom DeLay, takes on allegations of ethics violations. But first, medical research and Alzheimer's disease. If you're a medical professional who deals with Alzheimer's patients, or if you have a family member with the disease, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Dr. Mark Wexler is the Wright Professor of Medicine and Immunology at Weill Community Medical College of Cornell University in New York City. He joins us from his office there. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Also joining us is Dr. Ron Peterson. He's the director of Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the Mayo Clinic. He's with us by phone from WLRN in Miami, Florida. Hello?
I am. Yes. Right.
Nice to have you there.
Pleased to join you.
Thank you. Dr. Wexler, let's begin with you. Yesterday you presented the findings of your study. Briefly, can you summarize what this is?
Well, it's a study which is based on some events that have really changed the history of Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease was identified by a physician named Alzheimer 100 years ago. Amyloid was a protein that he identified to precipitate in the brain. But it was only 5 years ago that scientists really took aim at this toxic protein. It was known that injection of antibodies to this protein into mice with an Alzheimer-like disease prevented memory loss. And for that reason, 3 years ago, Dr. Relkin and I examined the blood of patients with Alzheimer's and age-matched control patients and found that Alzheimer's disease patients had a very low level of these antibodies, suggesting that they may contribute to the memory impairment seen in Alzheimer's disease. It was suggested that if we infused antibodies to the toxic protein from normal persons, this might aid patients with Alzheimer's disease. And we've just about concluded, 7 of the 8 patients have finished 6 months of therapy with a preparation called intravenous immunoglobulin, often referred to as IVIG, which is a concentrated preparation of antibodies from healthy individuals. And this study was really to test the correct dose to use and to make sure it was not toxic in patients with Alzheimer's disease. And we were really pleasantly surprised, although it was not a test of efficacy of this therapy, of the capacity of this therapy to stop memory decline, but we've seen it already in 7 patients, all 7 patients who've completed 6 months of therapy, none of them have continued to have memory loss. And in fact, 6 out of the 7 have had gain in memory function.
Now,
we're quite encouraged.
Again, only 8 patients, though. That's a little difficult to generalize from such a small sample.
Obviously, we're very cautious. This was not a placebo-controlled study. Everyone, the doctors, the nurses, the patients, their loved ones, knew they were getting a new medicine, and therefore they were justifiably optimistic. And the next phase 2 study, now that we've established the correct dose of the intravenous immunoglobulin that we will use, will include what is called a placebo, a agent which does not contain antibodies but resembles the antibody preparation every other way. And so we can really go forward and test more rigorously the effects on memory of these antibodies.
In the meantime, are these patients who did this 6 month course, are they going to continue to get IVIG?
Well, one of the most remarkable findings, which again is based on even smaller numbers, is when they concluded these 7 patients who concluded the test, 3 of them have now been off IVIG for 3 months, and their cognitive function, their memory has declined. And while this is sad news, and we've started them again on IVIG, hopefully to recapture the effect we saw before, we are very encouraged in a way that when they were taking the medicine, their memory improved, and when we stopped it after this fixed 6 months that we planned with the patients, that their memory declined. So there seems to be an association of improved memory with the administration of the antibody.
Yeah, cause and effect.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, IVIG is available for it's supposed to be for other purposes. It's already on the market. I have to tell you, if I read about this in the newspaper or heard this radio program, and if I had Alzheimer's disease, I'd be knocking on my doctor's door this morning.
Well, this is really always a problem. The problem is that we have good evidence that we should go further. But we don't have evidence sufficient to say that there is an indication. The FDA will require us to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that this medication is effective and safe for patients with Alzheimer's disease before they will allow us and they will deem it an indicated use of the medication. So for older people, it's a very expensive medication, although we have ways, we think, of preparing the IVIG in a much more cost-effective way. But for the moment, it would cost $5,000 to $10,000 a month, which is a lot of money. It is not covered for reimbursement because it hasn't been proved to my medical colleague's satisfaction that it is effective. But it is the first step.
Well, speaking of first steps and promising results, Dr. Peterson, let us turn to you. This morning, you also presented the results of a new study. Tell us about that.
Well, what we presented this morning was a study on what we call mild cognitive impairment. Now, mild cognitive impairment is what we think is a transitional stage between the memory and cognitive changes of normal aging and what are the very earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease. So we took these individuals who had this memory impairment, but again, were quite functional, were quite healthy, looking like normal individuals in the community, and we randomized them to one of three treatment groups. One treatment group got high-dose vitamin E. The second group got high-dose donepezil, or the usual dose of donepezil, I should say, 10 milligrams per day, which is one of the drugs on the market for Alzheimer's disease. And the third group got a placebo. We then followed them for up to 3 years, and the hypothesis in the study was that either the vitamin E or the donepezil would lower the rate at which these people would progress to Alzheimer's disease over the course of the study.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, what we found is that the vitamin E, unfortunately, did not have anything of an effect over the 3 years. The donepezil produced an interesting result that was somewhat variable. For the first 12 months of the study, the donepezil did reduce the risk of those individuals with this mild cognitive impairment progressing to Alzheimer's disease. But then as the study went on over the second and third year, the effect dissipated and the groups came together once again.
So what would be its, again, if this pans out, what is its prospective use?
Well, I think this is an important study because it's really the first time anyone has ever demonstrated the ability to push back the clinical diagnostic window of Alzheimer's disease. So it's the first time we've ever been able to postpone that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a huge amount. The reduced risk lasts only 1 year. But nevertheless, this is an attempt to get at the disease before it's fully developed in its typical fashion of what we know as Alzheimer's disease. So I think this opens the door for treatments perhaps like Dr. Wexler's and Relkin's down the road to intervene at an earlier stage in the disease process in hopes of forestalling any of the further damage to be done and maybe even preventing the disease ultimately.
Let me ask you both. This disease, Alzheimer's, has been a prescription for despair ever since it was discovered, as you said earlier, 100 years ago. This sounds like this was a great meeting this week in Miami. What's happening with all of these things coming together at the same time? Dr. Wexler?
Well, I think really we are learning a lot more. I think one has to date the really new approach to Alzheimer's disease to 1995, when we had the first mouse model of Alzheimer's disease. Mice live a shorter time. They develop the disease more quickly. It is not a perfect mimic of human Alzheimer's, but it let us get going. So that was 1995. By 2000, we already knew that if we infuse these mice with antibody, we could save their memory. And now, 3 years later, so we're going within a decade, which is really a terribly short time, to an animal model which lets us work more efficiently with an understanding of how the immune system might play a role in, and I also should add, not only in the therapy, but perhaps the diagnosis. Perhaps, as Dr. Peterson said, if we could identify people earlier, perhaps those which who had low levels of this antibody, we wouldn't wait until they had symptoms and forgetfulness. Not today, not tomorrow, but in 10 years, we might arrive and say, you, it's like high blood pressure and having a stroke. You have a risk factor. Your blood pressure is too high. You may have a stroke in the future. It may come that we will be in the same position with Alzheimer's disease. We will have a marker that will tell us this person is on the road to Alzheimer's. Let's get in early and prevent them from developing those symptoms.
And Dr. Peterson, would you agree that the mouse model, I mean, that's the thing that's causing all of this to come together?
I think it's definitely one of the major factors that we've learned more about the underlying biology of the disease. And as well, I think some of the longitudinal studies of humans that are out there are coming to fruition as well. These are studies that were started many years ago, observing elderly individuals who may be quite normal at that point in time, following them over many years and seeing what happens with respect to their memory and thinking. As would happen when you follow a large group of normal elderly individuals, some of them become gradually forgetful, and some go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. So we're starting to identify now the earliest features of the disease, pick it up clinically, pick it up with imaging tests, pick it up with biomarkers in the blood and elsewhere, such that when the basic science laboratory, like the animal model applications of the immunological findings to the disease, come together with these clinical populations that have been well characterized over many years, we then can bring together both the basic science, the clinical research, and put it into action and try and solve the disease.
We're talking about studies that give us new hope for Alzheimer's patients. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. TOTN at NPR.org. Back after the break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about new research on Alzheimer's disease that holds out the promise, eventually, of perhaps treatment and perhaps earlier identification. Joining us is Dr. Ron Peterson, Director of Alzheimer's Research at the Mayo Clinic, and also with us is Dr. Mark Wexler, Wright Professor of Medicine and Immunology at Weill Medical College of Cornell University, who's with us from his office in New York City. Let's get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255. You can also send us email at totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Mary Ellen, who's calling from South Bend, Indiana.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is really exciting news, but I have a couple of questions. 2 years ago, I was hospitalized with ITP, or thrombocytopenia, and it just kind of came out of the blue. And the treatment, part of the treatment was IVIG. And my question was, since, of course, I'm worried about getting Alzheimer's, if this somehow could act as a preventative, since I got it a couple of years ago. I mean, would I be that lucky? And also, might there be any connection between the fact that I got the ITP and my perhaps hereditary tendency toward Alzheimer's?
Dr. Wexler?
Hi, I think that's a wonderful question. You'll be pleased to know I was asked this question by a board-certified neurologist, so you know you're halfway on to a medical degree. The answer is we do not have the epidemiology experience because IVIG has been around for about 25 years. It's very, very effective for ITP. And the person who asked me that question at the meeting said, would my patients who had IVIG postpone or never get Alzheimer's disease? The question is a very good one. It's logical. The problem is most patients have to be 65 and often have not had IVIG over this prolonged period. Often, fortunately for the patients with ITP, IVIG clears their disease and they don't continue to take it.
So this would point to that part of the study where after 3 months of getting, after being off IVIG, the cognitive abilities of these test patients got worse.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Mary Ellen, it doesn't look like if it's going to do good, you may have to take more.
May have to go back again.
That's right.
Well, thanks for all the work you do with Alzheimer's.
Thanks very much for the phone call, Mary
Bye-bye.
Ellen. Appreciate it. Let's turn now to Steve, and Steve is calling us from Little Rock, Arkansas. Hello? Yes, you're on the air, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to put in a note of caution because I really don't feel like there's anything dramatically progressive about the work that's been described here today. I don't want to be too critical without having seen the details, but it seems to me like another case of small exciting finds that aren't really completely scientifically proved yet, tipping the balance of public opinion a little too far in the favor of enthusiasm. We all get enthusiastic about our work, but it sounds like any kind of great conclusion from these studies are pretty premature at this point.
Dr. Peterson?
Well, Steve, your skepticism is appropriate insofar as there certainly has been a lot of attention paid to Alzheimer's disease because it's very important in society, and sometimes I think the results do get overplayed. And I don't think either Dr. Wexler nor myself are trying to overrepresent these data. I think it's an interesting contrast here of two studies that are at different ends of the continuum. Dr. Wexler's study is in 8 subjects and is just starting, generating some very exciting data that will generate hypotheses, lead to a phase 2 study, hopefully a larger study, placebo-controlled, to see if, in fact, this therapy works in a larger scale over a longer period of time. Our study is, in fact, one of those phase 3 clinical trials where we, in fact, looked at almost 800 subjects, followed them for 3 years. And you're quite right. There wasn't a home run in our study. We showed that in patients with mild cognitive impairment, we could delay the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease for 1 year, but not 3 years as the study was designed. So these are small incremental steps, and I think that we have to take these in stride, put them in the proper perspective, do the appropriate clinical trials to get the answers.
But considering the bleak prospect for Alzheimer's patients, is there the problem, and their families, is there indeed, Dr. Wexler, the problem of people seizing on inconclusive or incomplete results and saying we need to go full-blown right away?
Yes, well, I must again compliment the telephone correspondent who called you, because I wish more of my patients had that willingness to keep an open mind. We find it quite easy to recruit patients when we're giving an experimental drug, because hope springs eternal, as they say, and everyone wants it. When we then go and say that we're going to another phase, some of the patients will have placebo, it's much harder to recruit patients because they do not have the skepticism and restraint. They are so excited by the possibility of a cure that they don't want to be in the placebo group. And your correspondent said it's very important to have larger studies with placebo so we can really compare people for whom the doctors and the nurses and the loved ones didn't know what they were getting. So the truth will out. But I must say that most patients, as Mr. Conan said, want the experimental drug. And that sometimes makes it very difficult for physicians who want to have the information so that Steve will have the data that he's demanding of us presented, because patients will say, well, no, I'm not so interested if I'm not assured of the experimental therapy.
Well, Steve, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. And Dr. Wexler, congratulations, and everybody, I'm sure, wishes you all the luck in the world. Appreciate
Thank
your
you
time
very
today.
Much.
Dr. Mark Wexler, Wright Professor of Medicine and Immunology at Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York, and he joined us from his office there. And with us now, millions suffer from Alzheimer's. Many families and medical professionals have an interest in new research and possible treatments. Trey Sunderland is chief of the geriatric psychiatry branch at the National Institute of Mental Health and a clinical researcher. He's with us by phone from his home in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Nice to have you on the program.
Good afternoon.
If, for example, a family member has Alzheimer's, what could I do with this new information?
Well, there are two people you're talking about. One is the family member with the Alzheimer's disease, and the other is the son or daughter who's coming to you in their office with fears about themselves developing the illness in the near future.
They fear they're carrying the genetic the gene for this.
And I just wanted to extend the theme that Ron Peterson talked about, which is the broad spectrum of people you deal with in the audience, who those who have Alzheimer's, those that are worried about getting it, and those that have the very beginning, perhaps, an MCI. It's the millions of people who are the baby boomers who have parents with Alzheimer's who might be most interested in this conversation and might say, well, if it works for Dad or Mom, may it work for me? And might I want to take it even now? And that's where we run into a big danger, because these unproven therapies are obviously not proven for Alzheimer's disease, much less for prevention.
I can understand that, and I can understand that in theory. If I had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I would not be willing to wait.
Right, and that's really what Dr. Wexler was talking about. There's a tremendous enthusiasm, and also and I would take it a little bit dark. It's really almost a desperation to try these new medicines, because the downside risk is relatively small if you consider it against the horror of Alzheimer's disease. So people are willing to do, and that's why we have very careful review boards, institutional review boards that do informed consent and make sure that we don't unnecessarily induce patients into these studies.
Now,
and we have to give them fair information.
In the case of AIDS, obviously another lethal disease and much faster acting than, for the most part, than Alzheimer's disease, but in the case of AIDS, acceleration has gone into the program. Would that be appropriate for these kinds of studies?
There has been discussion of that. I think it would be appropriate at some point if you have early, strong data to support its use. Then you might not need the 2 to 3 large-scale studies that Dr. Peterson talked about. You might need only one large-scale study shows positive results. But that is after you've gone through the preliminary pilot proof of concept study, like what Dr. Wexler described this afternoon. Then you go through phase 2 and then at least one large phase 3 trial. It's still a long and somewhat arduous process, but it's really for the safety of everyone who might have exposure to these medicines. And we need only look at the recent withdrawals of recent medicines to know that that is a potential problem.
Let's get some more callers back on the line. And this is Lori. Lori's calling from Livonia, Michigan.
Yes. Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My father passed away 2 years ago from Alzheimer's, and my siblings and I are deathly afraid of getting this terrible disease. Is there anything practical that any kind of an assessment that we can get now to see if we're going to get the disease, or is there anything we can do homeopathically that we can start doing right now to prevent it? Because I've heard of the connection between heart disease and Alzheimer's, which my father was also a patient of heart disease. So as you can imagine, you know, I'm very scared of this. I saw him decline so quickly, and it's just such a terrible disease.
Dr. Peterson?
Well, the answer, Lori, is somewhat complicated, and I think that probably the best thing you can do is just observe your diet, lifestyle factors, such as what's good for the heart is good for the brain. Watch your diet with regard to high fat. Get exercise. Be involved intellectually. Stay socially involved. And I think those are some practical suggestions, and there's some data indicating now that, in fact, those who have active physical and mental lifestyles may have a lower risk of developing Alzheimer's disease in the future. Of course, people always ask, what about taking this, that, or the other nutraceutical, right, or this vitamin or that vitamin? Unfortunately, the honest answer is we don't really know if any of these will, in fact, prevent the disease. We had been thinking about vitamin E. We just looked at vitamin E in our trial, and it was not effective. Now, that doesn't say it might not be effective in normal individuals preventing the disease in the mild cognitive impairment stage or in Alzheimer's disease, but we don't know that. And there are some risk factors, some risks with taking some of these vitamins. So I think the safest advice these days is to adapt your lifestyle to one of being active physically, intellectually, and watch your diet.
Great. Thank you very much.
I would just add to that that the drugs that may work for Alzheimer's may not work for people who don't yet have the illness. And it was alluded to earlier, but the idea of a biomarker, some early sign in the body other than just cognition, might be down the road a piece that will be able to identify people somewhat earlier, even before they get symptoms of memory problems. And then we'll have actual targets to monitor with these possible medications.
Well, that
now it's a little too premature.
That leads to this question that we got an email from Jean Labor in Minneapolis. Do the results of these clinical studies on Alzheimer's hold out any new hope for those of us who will suffer from other forms of dementia as we age?
I can say a couple words about that, Neil, that I think that we're learning more and more about the different features of dementia. So in addition to Alzheimer's disease, while Alzheimer's disease is still up and away the most common form of dementia, especially in individuals 65 years and older, there are some others, such as frontotemporal dementia, which is a different type of degenerative disease of the brain that involves, as the name implies, the frontal lobes and the front parts of the temporal lobes. It presents differently. The symptoms are somewhat different. The prognosis might be a little bit different. And certainly at this meeting of the American Academy of Neurology, there's a good deal of research being reported on frontotemporal dementia. Other forms of dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, vascular dementia, which means dementia related to strokes and the like. So the field is really broadening, and we're looking at all types of dementias as well as Alzheimer's disease, and sometimes these cross-fertilize each other, meaning that something we learn about one disease may be applicable to another disease. So we're certainly trying to find cures and treatments for virtually all of these, as well as improving our diagnostic techniques.
We're talking about new studies on Alzheimer's with Dr. Mark Wexler and, with Dr. Ron Peterson and Trey Sunderland, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Brian. Brian's calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I really appreciate you discussing this subject. I'm a nurse, and I work on a 20-bed unit strictly for Alzheimer's patients. And I, you know, work full-time there, 40 hours a week, and see the devastation it does to families. So I'm encouraged by the new studies, but I'm also sincerely concerned with the cost of these therapies that are being studied. I see people's finances, life savings being just wiped out in a matter of a few months in the care that's required for these patients. And obviously these are patients with intermediate to advanced stage Alzheimer's, but is there, you know, and we have a long history in America of not funding research and care for people with mental illnesses, which Alzheimer's is obviously a mental issue. Is there anything in the works to already to petition the governments for Medicaid, Medicare coverage for these type of treatments or anything like that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Brian. And just to refresh the recollection, Dr. Wexler told us earlier that the cost of this, if it does work, would be $5,000 to $10,000 a month, though he said there was hope for getting price reductions. Trey Sunderland, the price and the policy issue here.
There's a website called clinicaltrials.gov that I would suggest that this that Brian look. There are over 54 trials going on around the country of medications for Alzheimer's disease and people with MCI, mild cognitive impairment. And these are free to the public. It does mean entering a research study where there's a possibility of getting placebo, but that's certainly one alternative. In terms of the future use of these medicines, I think it's going to end up being a very important cost-benefit analysis that we will go through as a nation. If the medication truly has a preventative effect, that is to say it stops the illness before it starts, and we can identify people who are vulnerable, then that would have a massive effect on our economy and our individuals. We'd be willing to pay a lot of money for that, perhaps. If it has a mild symptomatic effect that just delays the course of the illness or prolongs the suffering of the illness, there might not. In fact, there are people in Britain that argue that some of the medicines we currently have are not worth the price we pay for them. So we are set up for a debate. But the issue is not whether we should use these medicines, but what the risk versus the benefit is.
And let me ask you, reading up on this story earlier today, people said that just a few years ago, Alzheimer's research was a backwater and poorly funded. What happened?
Well, I think the baby boomers are waking up to the fact that they're the next likely people to get this illness. We have very notable people who've gotten the illness, like President Reagan, and it is no longer a backwater. That clearly, if you look at any parameter, even in terms of research funding, in terms of number of publications, number of researchers interested, or just a general conversation, it's no longer quite as embarrassing for someone to discuss the fact that their family member had this illness. There is a sense, and I think you alluded to this at the very beginning of the show, that there's a new sense of optimism, as if we've turned a corner. Turn a corner of prejudice about this illness, much in the same way, in some way, that it happened with AIDS a number of years ago.
We're talking with Trey Sunderland at the National Institute of Mental Health, and he's also a clinical researcher. He's with us from Chevy Chase, Maryland, and Dr. Ron Peterson, director of Alzheimer's research at the Mayo Clinic. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Alzheimer's sufferers and possible treatments. We'll also talk about House Majority Leader Tom DeLay's continuing problems with ethics and with his colleagues on both sides of the aisle. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're going to wrap up our conversation about new research studies on Alzheimer's disease. Our guests are Dr. Ron Peterson, who's the director of Alzheimer's research at the Mayo Clinic, and Trey Sunderland, chief of geriatric psychiatric branch at the National Institute of Mental Health. He's also a clinical researcher. And let's get some more callers on the line. And this is Marge. Marge is calling from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. And the wonderful topic, just the anticipation of a possible cure for Alzheimer's, is elating. My mother in 1997 and my mother-in-law last year died as the complications of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And my maternal grandmother had brothers, siblings, both brothers and sisters that suffered and were a victim of this disease. Lori had called and asked for some ideas as to thwart this in ourselves, and you covered that quite well, and I have those. But I wanted to ask you something else. Anxiety. Both my mother-in-law and my mother experience anxiety. My aunt does, although she doesn't show any issues right with Alzheimer's. And I experienced it, and my doctor said, with my concerns on my history, he said, let's control this anxiety. And have you found anything as to any causative issues as to anxiety, with obviously that's emotional and mental, if that precipitates or possibly is a precursor of Alzheimer's?
Dr. Peterson?
Well, I can say a few words about that, but Dr. Sunderland, being a psychiatrist, can also add a couple comments. We're finding that, again, not in your situation by any means, or we don't mean to imply that, because some of these disorders, some of these symptoms like anxiety and depression itself are quite common in society. It doesn't mean that it leads to a disease down the road. However, we are also finding that some of these other symptoms, such as anxiety, depression, agitation, may be the earliest presentations of Alzheimer's disease or cognitive disorders down the road. So we're spreading out our diagnostic net to include not only just cognitive symptoms like forgetfulness and reading and writing problems, but also some behavioral characteristics, maybe some personality characteristics, and it may give us a better picture of who is destined to develop the disease. But on the other hand, these are very prevalent conditions in society, so just because a person is anxious doesn't mean that he or she is necessarily predisposed to developing Alzheimer's disease.
Do you think it might involve the serotonin or something on this nature that so often is talked about as to depression? Or
Trey Sunderland, did you want to get in on this?
Well, I'd just like to add what Dr. Peterson said, that certainly what's called late-onset depression, where it's not that you have anxiety or depression all your life, but rather develop for the first time after the age of 65. That has been associated with a greater likelihood to be going close to Alzheimer's disease. And if you think about Alzheimer's disease as a physical brain lesion, there are plaques and tangles that develop in the brain. They sometimes can develop in the areas of the brain that are associated with behavior, that is to say anxiety and depression, certainly in the frontal lobes. And those plaques might just hit circuits that are affected by affect anxiety and depression. So that's why we think we are seeing these symptoms, perhaps even before cognitive symptoms, in about 10% of cases. But if one has had a lifelong or intermittent anxiety, it is probably not a precursor to Alzheimer's, because, as Dr. Peterson said, it's just such a common variant of life.
Right. Thank you so much, very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Marge.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Aaron. Aaron's calling from Park Rapids in Minnesota.
Hi,
Aaron. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I have a question for Dr. Peterson. One of the questions I get from my doctors is continued treatment with donepezil. In your study, after 3 years, I know that all the patients kind of came together in terms of how many had dementia, but was there still a differential in terms of function and cognition? Like, were they at mild as opposed to moderate in the treatment group versus placebo, or did it come together all in terms of where they were on cognitively?
Dr. Peterson?
There's a good question, Aaron. I should ask you, how's the weather up there? Because I got to come back in a couple of days.
Yeah, but it's
beautiful today. Oh, good. It's warm down here, too.
Snow tomorrow.
In fact, There were cognitive symptoms that tracked the primary findings, meaning that the delay in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease lasted out to 12 months in what we call corrected data and actually out to 18 months in the uncorrected data. And the cognitive changes, the memory, the visuospatial skills, language, attention, executive functions, basically tracked that pattern so that by 3 years, most of that was lost. Except, I must add, in a subset of the patients, those who were apolipoprotein E4 positive, now this is a genetic characteristic of individuals that has one form has been shown to be a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. And interestingly, in that subset of patients in this study, the effect of the delay of the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease stretched out to either 24 or 36 months, and again, some of the cognitive effects also went out to that extent. So there are some interesting findings beneath the surface in the data set here that we need to explore further.
Aaron? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron. And let's see if we get one more call in on this subject. And this is Duane. Duane's calling from Punta Gorda in Florida. Duane, are you there?
Yeah, thank you. I'm 57 years old, and I have early Alzheimer's, and I'm a diabetic too. I eat a balanced diet, and I exercise, and I have a PhD in educational psychology and instructional design from Michigan State. My question is, can I expect a cure in the next 5 years?
That's the question. Dr. Peterson, do you want to try first?
Well, that's always a difficult question, a very good question, a relevant question, but it's always difficult to predict the exact time course. And unfortunately, because these, if we're talking about, say, a drug cure or a drug treatment, it really takes years for these to go through the proper safety trials before they are approved by the FDA. So I think in the next 5 years, I think we're going to make significant inroads into this disease. I think we're going to try to work on drugs and treatments that may have an actual effect on the underlying disease process, the biological process, not just the symptoms. And I think we'll make significant inroads in that area in the next 5 years. I'm not sure that will necessarily become a cure, but I think it'll move us in that direction.
I'm getting a new doctor from the VA this month, and I can ask her to look for a cure.
Yeah.
I came out with dementia about 2 years ago, and I own a business on finance with Primerica. And Primerica works with couples that are 25 and 45 to get them debt-free and financially independent without any money.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a retirement FNA for people that are 55 or over.
Yeah, Duane, when you get that new doctor, are you going to ask for IVIG?
Pardon me?
When you get that new doctor, are you going to ask that doctor for IVIG therapy?
Yeah, her name is Dr. Thacker, T-H-A-K-E-R.
Okay, Duane, thanks very much for the phone call, and good luck to you.
Neil, when a caller like Duane calls in, I think it pulls our heartstrings.
Yes.
Obviously, the answer is we might not have a cure. We probably will not have a cure within his period of having Alzheimer's. We'll have treatments that are better. But my approach in this situation is always ask, what about the family? What about their kids? I mean, and his going into a research trial will push science forward, will help push science forward, so that even if he doesn't get that much help, the next generation will. And it's really it's quite remarkable how these people do give of themselves in a very altruistic way, knowing full well, for the most part, that they're not going to get the direct benefit.
Trey Sunderland, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Trey Sunderland, chief of the geriatric psychiatry branch at the National Institute of Mental Health and a clinical researcher, joined us from his home in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And Dr. Ron Peterson, we thank you for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, on behalf of everybody listening, good luck. Dr. Ron Peterson is director of Alzheimer's research at the Mayo Clinic.